This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The growing militarization of the Red Sea coast and the conflict in Yemen have increased risks for security and stability, which calls for more cooperation, not competition, in this wider region.
That's EU Special Representative Alexander Rondos on efforts by the EU to limit the effects of conflict in the Horn of Africa area. Also, Malawians vote for president, parliament members, and local officials today. And health officials meet to discuss the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, people in Malawi are voting in 193 constituencies for president, members of parliament, and local councillors. 7 million voters are expected to cast ballots today. Hundreds of people lined up to vote in the Goliati voting station in southern Malawi. It is the home of the home village of President Peter Mutharika, who is seeking re-election. Voting today was largely peaceful, with few problems reported. An election observer for the ruling DPP party, Joseph Timothy, reportedly said the number of voters was high, as was expected. One voting problem involved Vice President Saulos Chilima. Chilima's name was not registered at the voting station where he went to vote, but at a station many kilometers away. Chilima was nevertheless permitted to vote because he was one of the candidates. Chilima is among three main competitors for the presidency in today's election. Opposition leader Lazarus Chakwera is the other. Official election results are expected on May the 29th. Talks between Sudan's ruling Transitional Military Council and an alliance of protesters and opposition groups failed for the second day in a row to produce a breakthrough on the country's political transition, the council said early today. The TMC and the Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces, an umbrella body of protesters and opposition groups, have agreed on a 3-year transition before elections, but have been deadlocked over whether civilians or the military would control a sovereign council that would hold ultimate power. Nabil Negima, a political analyst in Cairo, spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the reasons behind the deadlock.
Actually, it is quite a normal situation, you know. After 3 decades of suppression and dividing the society, Sudan, as I have seen it 2 days ago, it is a quite distorted state. President Omar al-Bashir has managed to destroy the public servant sector, the army, the police, most of the country's fundamental backbone. Now, after such 30 years of suppression, you get a lot of steam coming out. And it is quite natural that people are not up to the statehood level. And I find the situation in Sudan alarming.
But why the military is insisting to have more representation in the council?
From the military, the TMC, the Transitional Military Council's point of view, that they are not sure that the other side, the DFCF, the Declaration of Freedom and Change, is quite ready or up to the mission. So they want to have the upper hand in the situation. On the other hand, the civilian body, FTF, is calling such attitude as a way to sustain the military rule in Sudan. And some of them go far to describe it as a coup against a coup. I find it a way to minimize the differences. And maybe by middle of next week, they're going to get together to a middle point to save Sudan out of the unknown.
So would the pressure from the African Union produce a solution that meets the protesters' demand to have a civilian transitional government, or would the military be able to use security as an excuse for their continued grip on power?
To be honest with you, I find the AU influence is not useful at this moment. So USA, EU, and the Gulf States, their efforts to be coordinated with Egypt should get involved and tell Sudanese people, listen, you are not alone. We're going to support the state and we're going to save it from slipping into what Libya is going through and Yemen.
The TMC and the Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces have agreed on a 3-year transition before elections. Why did the Sudanese protesters agree to extend the transitional period to 3 years?
I believe very much that no party is ready to go through an election and get out safe. They are afraid of facing the music. The old-fashioned political powers were highly detached from the grassroots Sudanese people. In addition to that, there's another player, the youth, which is almost 55-60%. Those young Sudanese men and women are not into the old-fashioned way of doing things. So by agreeing on 3 years transitional period, everybody's giving itself a chance to breathe, to reorganize its political base and get ready for the election. But I think this transitional government, after maybe almost a year or maybe less than that, is going to face with great challenges that would push everybody to an early election. So I don't think we're going to wait 3 years to get elections in Sudan as they are planning now. I think an early election will be a de facto maybe within the next 10 to 12 months.
That was Nabil Nigma, a political analyst in Cairo, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. A panel of World Health Organization experts says strategies must be strengthened to combat the worsening Ebola epidemic in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The WHO's latest report counted 1,738 cases of Ebola in Congo, including 1,218 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO's annual conference in Geneva.
Congo's Minister of Health, Ole Ilungo, likens the Ebola epidemic to a multi-headed dragon. Speaking through an interpreter, he says the epidemic began in one place, Mangina, but keeps popping up elsewhere.
Our response, therefore, needs to continually adapt itself to the situation. We need to continually adopt and change our strategy, bearing in mind lessons learned.
Ilungo says prevention measures, surveillance, the tracing of infected people, timely treatment and safe burial practices must be maintained. At the same time, he says old tools need to be refreshed and improved. He proposes setting up a data-driven system which compiles all the information produced in the response effort.
Increasingly, we managed to carry out analyses that allow us to get ahead of the problem, and we can identify the danger areas where there might be a greater risk of the virus spreading, and we can get ahead of the problem.
The WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, finds the increasing number of new Ebola cases extremely worrying and challenging. She warns the risk of the disease spreading beyond Congo's borders is very high. She says the DRC's nine neighboring countries are aware of the dangers and, with the help of the WHO, have taken many steps to prepare for that possibility.
We have 16 Ebola treatment centers and units having been established across the nine countries. And in addition, over 4,500 health workers have been trained to be able to detect and manage Ebola cases. The countries have continued to engage with communities to raise their awareness in all high-risk areas.
WHO officials are appealing for intensified international political engagement and financial support to combat Ebola. They warned the further spread of the dangerous disease would have serious social and economic regional implications and would trigger an even greater crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight Live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. And at 6... And at 16 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Voting is underway in the Eastern African country of Malawi. World Health Organization experts say efforts must be strengthened to combat the Ebola epidemic in the eastern DRC. And in Sudan, the military and protesters continue discussions on a transitional government. The president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Felix Tshisekedi, has named Sylvester Ilunga as the next prime minister. A spokesman for the president said yesterday that Ilunga was appointed under what he called the political agreement between Tshisekedi and former President Joseph Kabila. That agreement, he said, called for creation of a coalition government. Ilunga has served in government for many years. His assistants say he is 78 years old. Tshisekedi was sworn in on January 24th. Although there were accusations of vote rigging, the election was marked as the first peaceful transition of power in the country since it gained independence from Belgium in 1960. However, Kabila remains a powerful figure in Congolese politics. Ilunga thanked Kabila for being named prime minister. Tshisekedi has said he wants to place importance on the issues of education, health, security, and establishing peace. However, reforms may be difficult as supporters of Kabila remain in many powerful positions. Opposition leader Moise Katumbi returned home yesterday from exile. He was met by thousands of supporters at Lubumbashi Airport. A court overturned a prison sentence against him for fraud last month, permitting his return. Katumbi, who fled the country in 2016, also was accused of plotting against former President Kabila. Tshisekedi has pardoned 700 prisoners, including several political opponents of Kabila. In South Africa, the ruling African National Congress Party has decided to amend the constitution to make it easier to seize land from white people without compensating them. The ANC maintains this is necessary to bring about equality in land ownership in the country, where most commercial farms remain in the hands of about 30,000 white farmers. Some supporters of the ANC's land reform plan say land expropriation must happen because white farmers and their unions don't want to share the land with their black compatriots. But as Darren Taylor reports in the third part of his series on land reform, in many cases the reality is much different.
Security is tight at one of the many events being held to discuss the ANC's land reform plan. One of the people going through the police checkpoint is Dris Visser. He's a big, balding, bearded sheep farmer from Northern Cape Province.
Dit is ons doel, denk ik, op aarde.
Our purpose on Earth is to improve the planet, and for sure, we're in this country to make it a better place.
Critics of the ANC say it's had a quarter of a century to establish more black farmers, but through a mix of mismanagement and corruption, it has mostly failed to do so. When Visser saw that land reform wasn't happening in his area, he took matters upon himself. He mentored one of his workers' children, who's now also a commercial farmer. Visser is paying for several black youngsters to attend agricultural college. Eddie Prince-Lewis strides in. He farms in the Free State, a province with a reputation for conservatism and racial division. But Prince-Lewis, who's also a sheep farmer, says he's never followed these paths. Even during apartheid, he gave animals to his black workers and helped them to make money by setting up their own breeding operations and auctions. 2 years ago, Prince-Lewis went much further. He approached the state to transfer one of his two farms to his laborers, transforming them into commercial farmers.
People ask me, how could you give such a beautiful farm to your workers? But I wanted to do it. It was the right thing to do. My personal opinion about land reform is that every Christian white farmer in South Africa must empower his workers in some way. The mindset of every white farmer must change.
Prince-Lewis says as long as most black people live in poverty, without pride or privilege, South Africa is doomed. He realizes, however, that not every white farmer is wealthy enough to give land away. In that case, says Prince-Lewis, they should contribute what they can toward training and development of new black agriculturalists. Visser is adamant that seizing white-owned land will do more harm than good. But he argues it's a good way to force white farmers out of the country they love.
When I listen to the talk about expropriating land without compensation, then the first thing that comes into my mind is, can we really afford to lose our top food producers?
Kan ons bekostig?
Threatened by crime and now land expropriation, hundreds of white farmers have already left South Africa to till land across the world. In recent years, just 12 of them have transformed Zambia from a net importer of maize to a net exporter. Prince-Lewis is, however, optimistic that white farmers like him have a future in South Africa.
The president is a farmer. The chairman of the ANC, Gweri Montashe, is a farmer. We support them. They're not the enemies of the white farmer. Together, we are going to make land reform work in this country.
But if it doesn't work, say business researchers, South Africa will join countries like Portugal, Vietnam, and Zimbabwe, where threats to private property ownership in the past caused extreme economic decline. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Today, the European Union announced plans to bolster efforts aimed at preventing and mitigating the impact of conflict in cross-border areas in the Horn of Africa. In a speech read on her behalf by the EU Special Representative, Alexander Rondos, EU Diplomatic and Security Chief Federica Mogherini said the aim is to promote peace, resilience, and economic development among communities in the borderland areas.
The European Union, through the Emergency Trust Fund for Africa, is supporting the $76 million US dollar groundbreaking program covering the Kenya-Ethiopia border, southwest Somalia, and cross-border area between Ethiopia and Sudan.
Unfortunately, in recent years, the Horn of Africa's biggest asset, its strategic location bordering the Gulf of Aden and overlooking southern access to the Red Sea, has made it an arena of heightened international competition. The growing militarization of the Red Sea coast and the conflict in Yemen have increased risks for security and stability, which calls for more cooperation, not competition, in this wider region.
The initiative, launched in 2015, aims to promote border security and enhance cross-border trade and greater resilience among the pastoralist communities in those areas. It is a collaborative effort between the EU, the United Nations, and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, member states.
Changes in Ethiopia transformative. The Ethiopian Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, with his outreach to his neighbors, has laid the foundations for such changes, and which we wish to sustain. The needs for job creation in Ethiopia and in the region are immense, in particular for the youth, which has a key role to play in the prosperity and stability of that country, Ethiopia, and the wider region.
Mogherini is on a three-day regional visit to the Horn of Africa, including Somalia, Kenya, and Djibouti.
The latest developments in the Horn reflect profound changes within societies and in the international environment around the region. To see where Eritrea and Ethiopia were at the beginning of last year and to see where they are now should be an inspiration, not just for the continent, but way beyond. The recent developments in Sudan could also have the ingredients of history in the making, if the Sudanese people's legitimate demands are addressed by all sides and in good faith.
In Nairobi, Mogherini held high-level meetings with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and other high-ranking government officials. On Monday, the EU diplomat toured Mogadishu, Somalia, and said the EU is committed to the realization of peace and stability in the Horn of Africa. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned for the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Xiaogang Chang, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, across the United States are numerous African diaspora associations. Many strive to preserve their culture or have advocacy goals. The role of the African diaspora in the United States.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is James Butty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.